What happened to Otto Warmbier today on The World? I'm Carol Hills. American student Otto Warmbier died after being imprisoned by North Korea. Today, President Trump said North Korea's Kim Jong-un told him he was not aware of what happened.
He tells me that he didn't know about it, and I will take him at his word.
Also, France argues about women who wear the hijab again.
The words multiculturalism, diversity, inclusivity are to France what Voldemort is to Harry Potter. You know, they who must not be named, don't say it, it's a bad word.
Plus, our reporter's ship arrives at Antarctica's huge Thwaites Glacier, and melting ice means she's getting an unprecedented view.
Some of the portions that we're seeing, we are the first humans to see.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. In the end, it was all about the sanctions. That's the obstacle President Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un could not overcome at their summit in Hanoi. Trump said he was not prepared to ease U.S. sanctions on North Korea at this time. Kim, it seems, would not budge without it. So the summit ended with no deal on denuclearization. Here's more from The World's Matthew Bell.
Smiles, handshakes, and warm words, they were not enough. Even after the negotiations broke down, President Trump said he was disappointed North Korea is missing a golden opportunity.
I want to take off the sanctions so badly because I want that country to grow. That country has got such potential.
There's only one thing to do now, says Brad Sherman. He's a Democratic congressman from Southern California.
The only way we're going to get a good deal is to ratchet up the sanctions. We are not doing all we should.
North Korea is currently under U.S. and United Nations sanctions. Sherman says those sanctions need to go one big step further.
You've got to sanction the large Chinese banks that do business with North Korea. You have to sanction other Chinese entities. If you don't put on more pressure, there's no reason to expect Kim is going to offer a better deal.
President Trump came into office talking about a maximum pressure campaign against North Korea. Former CIA analyst Bruce Klingner says the administration never put that policy into action.
For example, in June of last year, right before the Singapore summit, Trump said he doesn't even want to use the term maximum pressure anymore because we're talking so nicely to North Korea. And he also stated that he was not sanctioning 300 North Korean entities. Now, that means 300 North Korean entities violating U.S. law that we have evidence for.
Klingner, who's with the Heritage Foundation, says the Trump administration doesn't need to wait for new legislation from Congress to act. There's existing law on money laundering that could be used against North Korean entities.
The U.S. had imposed $8 to $9 billion in fines on European banks for money laundering for Iran. We've imposed $0 in fines on any Chinese bank for money laundering for North Korea. So there's more that can be done.
There are risks, of course. Punishing Chinese banks could invite retaliation from Beijing. Tougher sanctions could also lead to more missile tests or another nuclear test by North Korea. But Jonathan Schanzer of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies says there's no better way to push Kim Jong-un toward a deal on denuclearization, starting with banks in China.
We need to be looking at Russia. That has also been pivotal in terms of sanctions evasion. We need to be looking at Chinese ships, which have been engaging in these ship-to-ship transfers. There's a range of illicit activity that we know is taking place that is keeping North Korea functioning because they're not going through the front door. It's all backdoor stuff, and we have a glimpse into what's happening here. My understanding is that the U.S. has a plan for maximum pressure. We're just simply not implementing it because the president is interested in keeping that door open with Kim.
Trump's optimistic comments at the end of the summit suggested that door would indeed remain open. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
At Trump's end-of-summit press conference, the president also talked about Otto Warmbier. He was the American college student who died in 2017 after being imprisoned by North Korea. Warmbier's case received a lot of attention over several months.
Otto Warmbier was paraded before cameras in Pyongyang today. The University of Virginia undergrad tearfully apologized for trying to steal a political banner from a hotel.
I have been very impressed by the Korean government's humanitarian treatment of severe criminals like myself.
Sentenced to hard labor. He finally returned to his home state of Ohio.
His neurological condition can be best described as a state of unresponsive wakefulness.
Bad things happened, but at least we got him home to be with his parents, where they were so happy to see him, even though he was in very tough condition.
Tonight, his death is still a mystery, but the outrage over it is mounting.
Today, Trump said he raised Warmbier's case with North Korea's leader and that he believed Kim was unaware of the student's ordeal while he was imprisoned.
He tells me that he didn't know about it, and I will take him at his word.
Mickey Bergman is vice president of the Richardson Center for Global Engagement, and he was one of those who helped negotiate Warmbier's release right before the student died. Mickey, Trump says Kim Jong-un was unaware of the mistreatment of Otto Warmbier. You know the case inside out. Is that plausible?
So I think that President Trump probably did not articulate himself very well. I'm not in the business of defending the president, but I suspect that what he was trying to say is that Chairman Kim indicated to him that he did not know what led to Otto's condition and that it was not intentional, which is very different than not knowing that he was in that condition.
It's still a little, I think what still comes across when you hear President Trump is that he's willing to take Kim Jong-un at his word and not kind of probe or push on this issue.
Yes, it does sound like that. And I want to put it, I think I put it in context. And let me, if I can tell a little story that will maybe explain why I say what I say about this again, because I'm not in the business of defending the president at all. When we learned, myself and Governor Richardson, who I work with, when we were negotiating on behalf of the Warmbiers for Otto's return, we learned of Otto's medical condition only after he cleared the airspace of North Korea. It was a shocking, was a devastating blow to us. And immediately after, of course, we were furious with our North Korean counterparts, the ones that we were negotiating with, all the way up to the Vice Minister of Foreign Affairs that I negotiated with in Pyongyang just a couple of months before that. And the North Koreans made an effort with me personally, again, all the way up to the Vice Minister of Foreign Affairs, to let me know, to convince me that they didn't know themselves about Otto's condition when they were negotiating with me. Now, whether that was correct or not correct, I can talk about in a second, but the point and the value in this is that they saw enough value and had an interest in our relationship to go an extra mile to try and convince me that they were not negotiating in bad faith.
So were you able to find out any answers to what had happened to Otto Warmbier? How he did end up in a coma?
Yeah, so I have my own assessment and analysis based on some information that I have. In the interest of protecting the privacy of the Warmbier family, I try not to indulge in that. What I can say is that what I think was made public as well from it, we know that what led to Otto's condition was a singular event. So it was not a deterioration over time. It happened at once. It happened a long time before we got him back home. It actually probably happened within a few weeks after his trial. Now, what caused it, we don't know. We know that the North Koreans, and that's what I think what President Trump was articulating, are arguing that whatever happened was not intentional, but we don't know what it is.
Some sort of trauma, some single kind of blow?
Yeah, some sort of trauma that basically caused his condition. Now, the one thing I would say, if I may, if we look at historically at the U.S. prisoners, detainees, hostages held in North Korea, Otto Warmbier was different than the others. The others came back more or less in good health. We didn't have an incident like that. And so the Otto case was not actually the rule. It was an exception to the rule from that perspective. It doesn't take, and I need to be very clear, it does not take an inch out of the North Korean accountability, full accountability to what had happened to him, whether it was intentional, whether it was a mistake, whether something else happened. They were responsible for his health as a country, and so they're accountable for it.
Mm. How are his parents doing?
I saw them a couple of months ago. I tried to stay in touch. Look, parents that lose a child like that, especially their firstborn, it's devastating. They're coping. They have two more kids. And part of their decision was that they do not want their other two kids' life to be defined by what happened to Otto. But when I saw them, again, they're still grieving. Obviously, they will grieve forever, but they're still in that process of understanding and getting adjusted to a new kind of life.
Mickey Bergman helped negotiate the release of the late North Korean hostage, Otto Warmbier. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There are measles outbreaks popping up all over the world, including here in the U.S. Falling vaccination rates have a lot to do with it, but could politics be a factor too? Jonathan Kennedy thinks so. He teaches global health at Queen Mary University in London, and he's the author of a new study that links the rise of political populism in Europe to skepticism over vaccines there.
So put simply, we see that countries with high levels of support for populist parties also have high levels of vaccine skepticism. So if we look at countries like Greece or Italy or France, they have very strong, very well-supported populist movements, and they also have high levels of vaccine skepticism. And also, on the other hand, you have countries with low levels of populism and also low levels of vaccine skepticism. So these are countries like Belgium and like Portugal.
What's most concerning about your findings?
If we look at the MMR vaccine in particular,
Measles, mumps, rubella.
That's measles, mumps, rubella. You need something like 95% of the population to be vaccinated in order to have what we call herd immunity. So this is having enough people vaccinated so that you don't have outbreaks. And, you know, the real sad thing is it's not just the children of vaccine skeptics who suffer. It's actually children who can't be vaccinated for medical reasons because they have compromised immune systems. So this is children, for example, who are suffering from cancer and are having chemotherapy, so they can't be vaccinated. And these are people that suffer also. So it's some of the most vulnerable people in the world are being made more vulnerable by this. That's the most concerning thing for me.
People don't vaccinate their kids for all sorts of reasons. I mean, in the U.S., it's you know, way across the political spectrum. A lot of kind of, you know, progressive types don't. And then there's religious concerns. There's somebody had a bad, you know, experience. There's all sorts of reasons. I wonder, in your study, I mean, how do you assign it to political populism? I mean, how do you make, it's a correlation, but how do you say that that's the reason why?
I think we have to look at what populism fundamentally is, and we often think about populism as just being in the sphere of politics, but actually populism is much more far-reaching than that. Populism is a distrust and a hostility towards elites and experts. And so in the political sphere, this seems to be leading to an increase in support for anti-establishment parties and the rejection of the traditionally powerful centre-left, centre-right parties.
One of the most famous anti-vaxxers, of course, is Andrew Wakefield, a discredited former doctor. He famously wrote that article in 1998 in The Lancet linking vaccines to autism. It was totally discredited. Why do you think that it still has currency, that view?
I mean, I'm not really sure. It's been totally discredited, as you say. Wakefield's been struck off as a doctor. He can no longer practice as a doctor. And the vast majority of medics and of people with knowledge of public health give his ideas no currency whatsoever. I guess the reason why he still has some support, and actually he has quite a lot of support, right? He's still remarkably popular among some people. I think he attended one of President Trump's inaugural balls.
Yes, he did. They've had conversations.
Was reported in The Guardian to be dating Elle Macpherson. So in a way, he's doing very well. But I think the reason why his ideas still have currency is because they fit well with this post-truth era, or an era where there's been a decay in truth and an increase in distrust in the state and in big business and in authorities of all sorts.
Jonathan Kennedy is the author of a new study that links the rise of populism to skepticism over vaccines. He teaches global health at Queen Mary University in London. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you.
One family with roots on both sides of Kashmir's line of control. That's up next here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. India and Pakistan seem to take a step back today after several days of military hostilities and rising tensions, all, of course, over Kashmir. The two nuclear-armed nations each claim the region as their own, and each only controls some of it. It's been that way since 1947 and the end of British colonial rule over the subcontinent. That's also when Pakistan and India split up into predominantly Muslim and Hindu nations. Our BBC colleague Anu Anand has found family roots on both sides of the border created by that partition.
So my father's family was near Rawalpindi, which is today in Pakistan. Of course, at that time, it was all one country. And my mother's family was just a few miles away from that line that was drawn by the British. They were in a little village called Nashera, which is still on the Indian side. But it was definitely in the area where a lot of the violence broke out as the, you know, as the uncertainty and the fear and the mistrust was suddenly unleashed when that border came into being.
And why were they forced to leave?
They were forced to move my father's family because they were Hindus and they were going to end up being in a country that was basically, in their eyes, going to be majority Muslim. And it is majority Muslim. And so I think for them, there was a fear factor. So they left voluntarily a number of months before the violence broke out. My mother's family, however, they were like tens of millions of other families. They did not think that the new border was going to matter. They thought that people would still be able to move freely. And then once that border came into being, what happened was that, you know, Hindu mobs and Muslim mobs, this hatred was unleashed. And people went on the rampage trying to kill each other. And my mother's parents were caught up in that sudden wave of violence. They suddenly had mobs coming towards their village. They were warned. And they just managed to grab their children and escape. My grandfather lost a whole side to his family. The men killed the women to spare them from rape and murder, and then they committed suicide. And my grandmother lost her only brother. Now, that side of the family, my mother's side, they continue to live in Jammu and Kashmir, in the Indian state where you see today's conflict rearing its head again.
I mean, that's a profound tragedy. I mean, how do you make sense of that? Or how did your mother make sense of that?
So they never did. You know, that's the crazy thing. Nobody ever talked about it. Nobody talked about it. I think I probably learned about partition as an adult and then started to ask questions. And this is a very common story in many families. And I think the way that I explain it now, because I've thought about it a lot and asked a lot about it, I think that for my grandparents, there were two choices. The choice to survive and to build a happy life and a successful life, which they eventually did, or to dwell on the loss and the grief and the abject fear of what they'd been through. And I think, like so many families, they got on with life. My mother's parents went on to have four other children. My mother was the first post-partition baby. They went on to build a successful business, build a house, and my parents went on to be successful themselves. And I think when you talk to a lot of families, a lot of my friends who, you know, whose ancestors were caught up in the same sort of tragedy, you hear very similar stories. Some people went to the Far East and built whole new lives overnight. Others went to Europe or America and they just got on with it.
How did your mother and father meet?
My mother and father had an arranged marriage, like so many millions and millions of South Asians. And, you know, my mother went to live with my father in New Delhi. And a year after I was born, they moved to the U.S.
Have you been back to Kashmir?
Many, many, many times. I used to go as a child to visit family. I remember one trip where hostilities between the two sides had stoked up again. And there were curfews in Jammu. You could not turn on the lights. You couldn't walk around during the day. You know, you just had to stay inside. I remember stories about how my grandfather had one of the first television sets in the town because at the time, the Indian government heavily restricted TV ownership because you could get broadcasts from the enemy side. You were that close to the border. And so, you know, I can remember the conflict kind of spilling over into our lives, even, you know, long after, you know, the main bone of contention over the border had settled into a kind of uneasy truce.
What's it like for you today to see this conflict escalate between India and Pakistan all over again over Kashmir?
It is profoundly sad and frustrating. It's always there. We know that that border is disputed. We know there's been no progress made for more than 70 years. But when it gets violent, you have to ask yourself, you know, whether anyone's really serious about even trying to resolve it now. There's been so much history and so many wars, and there is this kind of frozen truce. And I think that what's really sad is that those same arguments and those same hatreds about religion and identity get played out all over again. I mean, of course you have a legitimate political argument about the border and a legitimate military and security issue. But what fuels the rhetoric and the policy, I think, is more to do with the feelings of ordinary people on both sides. In India, over the last couple of weeks, you know, you've had the most vitriolic debate about Pakistan. You've also had a lot of people appealing for calm and rationality and peace and, you know, trying to calm it down. But you've had, you know, Indian television debating bizarre things like, well, how many nuclear casualties would we be willing to take in this war with Pakistan? I mean, that's profoundly discouraging and sad in 2019. So I think, like a lot of people, I feel like, you know, I'm sitting here talking to you today because of the violence of that time and the effect it had on my family, the fact they left. And we're sitting here talking about the conflict that's going on right now because of what happened all those many years ago. And I would hope that at some point somebody's going to put, you know, people before politics, and the two sides may find a way to work it out. But I fear that that's not really going to happen in my lifetime.
You're a journalist, and when you go to Kashmir as a journalist, is it strange for your family who's still there to have you in a profession where you have to kind of look at the thing objectively and look at both sides?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think they kind of hate it. Because I scrutinize them, and they don't expect me to do that. I think they feel like the way they feel should just be respected. And I think that it makes them uncomfortable. I get a lot of, sometimes on social media, a lot of hatred as well from Indians saying that I'm sort of betraying my own people, you know, just by asking the questions or by simply reporting facts that maybe don't play favorably to one community or the other. But, you know, that's what journalists do. We, you know, for whether it's for personal reasons or for reasons of reporting, we look for the truth.
The BBC's Anu Anand speaking to us about her own family's history in Kashmir, the disputed region at the heart of the recurring conflict between India and Pakistan. I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, stand-up comedy in Saudi Arabia.
Okay, the title of my talk today is going to be, haha, wait, what? It's the title, and it's also the number one response when I tell anybody I am a Saudi stand-up comedian.
The risks Saudi comedians take in the kingdom's booming entertainment scene, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. People everywhere like to laugh. But comedy can be dangerous if it touches on politics in places where that's a sensitive subject, places like Saudi Arabia. The World's Shirin Jafari heard about a new comedy scene springing up there and checked it out.
It's a full house at Al Comedy Club in Jeddah, the port city on the western side of the country. Tonight, a handful of Saudi comedians are performing on stage. Judging by the audience's reaction, they're really funny. I, on the other hand, have to rely on my translator. Good thing he can sit next to me, because until recently, men and women would have been segregated. The comedian points to a couple in the audience. Are you married? Yes, they answer.
Do you have kids? How many? Two. Their ages?
He asks the husband if he's ever changed diapers, willingly. The wife answers for him. No, not willingly. They go back and forth, and the punchline...
Life is participation. Anything you do, I do.
I'll admit, I didn't get it, but people are laughing, so it must be funnier in Arabic. Stand-up comedy and public entertainment in general has always been restricted in Saudi Arabia, says Hala Al-Dosari, a scholar at New York University. She remembers what it was like when she was growing up in the late 1970s.
There was no public event, no entertainment. Most of the Saudis, including my own family, would travel outside Saudi Arabia to spend their holidays or vacations. My family would go to Egypt all the time in order to have some more of a relaxed social atmosphere.
Things began to shift in the early 2000s when Saudis got online. YouTube became a popular platform for comedians to share their material with a wider audience. But even then, it was unthinkable that one day the kingdom would open up to not only comedy clubs, but also to cinemas, concerts, and public entertainment in general. So why is the Saudi government, specifically Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, letting this happen now? Al-Dosari says it's for two reasons.
One of them is to promote Mohammed bin Salman as the visionary modernist leader and to acquire the legitimacy, basically, from the international business community, international political circles.
The other, she says, is that cinemas, comedy clubs and concerts employ young Saudis, and the government wants them to be employed. The performers at Al Comedy Club in Jeddah are all men. Women like Hatun Ghadi are still fighting to get into the business.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ghadi hosts a YouTube comedy show called Nuna Laswa. Some of her episodes have more than 1 million views. She describes her comedy as social satire that mostly focuses on issues that affect women. Last summer, when the driving ban was lifted, she joked that it actually worked in favor of Saudi men.
It was that the most important man in a Saudi woman's life is the driver. So when the ban was lifted, I said, look, now the Saudi man can gain back his original position as being the most important man in his woman's life. So at the end of the day, this decision was in favor of men, not for women.
Ghadi says she's had to claw her way into the comedy scene here. She was convinced early on that Arabic networks wouldn't accept her as she is.
When you enter their doors, they will just look at you up and down and tell you what you need to do. If you are exceptionally talented, then okay, you need to lose 10 pounds, you need to do a nose job, you need to do some potex, you need to do, even in the Arab media. Yes.
Even in Saudi?
Well, most of the big stations, they are owned by Saudis. So yes, it applies to all the stations.
As a comedian working in a conservative society, Ghadi has set herself some boundaries, topics she won't touch.
Racism, of course, religion, of course, sexual references, and profanity. I just stay clear from them.
But Hala Al-Dosari says in Saudi Arabia, the red lines are not so clear, and that can be dangerous for comedians.
The lines between what is allowed and what is not allowed is a moving target. So it's very difficult to follow any kinds of comedy show. And of course, understandably, not all of them have continued because of the restrictions.
Fahad Al-Butari has been dubbed the Jerry Seinfeld of Saudi Arabia. He got interested in comedy when he was a student at the University of Texas, Austin. By 2008, he was a YouTube celebrity in Saudi Arabia. His videos got millions of views. Here he is at a TED Talk in 2011.
Okay, the title of my talk today is going to be, haha, wait, what? It's the title and it's also the number one response when I tell anybody I am a Saudi stand-up comedian. Exactly.
A few years ago, Al-Butari worked with Kirk Rudell, a writer and producer in Los Angeles. When Al-Butari went back to the Middle East, the two stayed in touch, mostly on Twitter. In January, Rudell went to message Al-Butari.
There was no account. And so that already was shocking to see. He had, I think, about 3 million followers. And there was just gone. And so any trace of my messages with him was gone.
Al-Butari's wife, a human rights advocate, was gone too. Rudell found out that she'd been arrested. She's still in jail today. And Al-Butari, he's nowhere to be found. Rudell was shocked. He wrote about it on Twitter.
I'm a terrible fundraiser. I don't like marching, but I can tell stories. And so the only thing I felt I could do for them, at least, was tell their story and try to share it and hope that whatever they were going through right now, they would be less alone.
But the Saudi government hasn't responded to Rudel's plea or any request to release the activist.
Just a few months ago, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, a.k.a. MBS, was hailed as the reformer the Arab world needed.
That same month, comedian Hasan Minhaj took a shot at the Crown Prince on his Netflix show, Patriot.
Meanwhile, every Muslim person you know was like, yeah, no sh**. He's the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia.
The Saudi government didn't think it was funny. It told Netflix to take the video down. The company complied and was widely condemned for caving to Saudi pressure. And all this makes you wonder, is the opening up of the comedy scene in Saudi Arabia really meaningful? Hala Al-Dosari of New York University says while on the surface it might look like the country is loosening its restriction on entertainment, deep down it has a long way to go. She says putting limits on what an artist can create takes away the purpose of art altogether.
This is the thing, is you can have entertainment, you can have people performing, but where is the creativity? Where is the relevance of art to everyday life?
Without creative freedom, she says, art is reduced to a tool for consumerism. For The World, Shirin Jafari, Jeddah.
The World's Shirin Jafari joins me in the studio now. Shirin, your stories from Saudi Arabia have painted a really vivid picture of how the kingdom's culture is changing in many ways, but there's also limits to those changes. What was the biggest takeaway from your visit to the kingdom?
My biggest takeaway, Carol, is that change is happening on the ground, but it's happening very slow. One example is the story I reported yesterday about how women are now able to ride their bikes in some part of the country. Another story was the one I reported last week about how women are now able to commute to work because they're able to drive their own cars. At the same time, the change is coming really slow, and some people are paying a heavy price for these changes to happen.
What do you mean by that?
For example, there are a group of women's rights activists who campaigned for the lifting of the driving ban for years. But as the ban was lifted, they were arrested and they are in jail right now. And there are reports that some of them have been tortured.
And were you able to do any reporting on that?
I was not. So the Saudi government assigns a minder to all journalists who are working in the kingdom. And I had to give them a list of the stories that I was working on and the people I was going to meet before I went to Saudi Arabia. But I did manage to speak to Saudis on the streets and in the malls and at comedy clubs like the one in my story we just heard.
Shirin, I'm curious, in your downtime in Saudi Arabia, were you able to just wander around and do whatever you wanted?
Yeah, I was able to go anywhere I wanted to go, and I did go out to eat, and I went to restaurants.
And that was without a minder?
Yeah.
When you were just kind of wandering around, did you see, were most public places still segregated by sex, or was it much more integrated?
No, that's actually one of the biggest changes that's happened in Saudi Arabia recently. Before, men and women were segregated in public spaces. So, for example, in restaurants and cafes, you would see a family section and there's the male section, single men section. But this has changed now. It's interesting because you can see the signs where it says male only and then family only. But in cafes and restaurants, you can see people mingling together.
Thanks a lot, Shirin. It was a great series.
Thank you so much, Carol.
A specialized hijab for sports means Muslim women can run, jump, and compete and still keep their hair covered. It's not a new idea, but when the product was marketed by the major sporting goods store Decathlon in France, there was a backlash. It's been the talk of the country lately, and it's not just about sportswear. Rimsara Alouane is following this debate closely. She's a human rights researcher in Toulouse, France. The backlash against the idea of a sport hijab has been really intense. What have people been saying?
Well, we have politicians who has been instrumentalizing for years the concept of separation of church and state, going after French Muslims every time they can, saying that it was a violation of women's rights and, you know, we are going to free women. So those kind of sportswear item should not be provided because it's an attack on women's rights. But of course, it's very selective kind of attitude. We are going to save you. We're going to free you, but on our terms.
So people in Macron's own government have been voicing their opinion on this. What have they been saying? Mm-hmm.
So our Minister of Health declared that this was contrary to the French value of the Republic.
A spokeswoman for President Emmanuel Macron also weighed in on this issue.
Aurore Berger, who is also a specialist of this kind of attack, basically saying the same thing, how the hijab is a symbol of oppression, that we need to counter this. And again, the same kind of patriarchal, you know, attitude telling women how they should dress.
What sort of response has the chain store Decathlon, what sort of response have they gotten?
It was unprecedented, but Decathlon received a lot of threats, not only verbal abuse, but also more serious threats of death threats as well, to the point that, so they tried to respond, you know, pretty gracefully, and they had to suspend this project of selling the hijab running for security reasons because the employees were threatened.
So the Decathlon store has said it will not sell the specialized hijab for sports.
At least it's suspended for now. You know, honestly, between you and I think they will bring back the sport hijab in a more maybe discreet way.
But some are arguing against the backlash. I mean, some are defending the sale of this specialized hijab for sports. What are they saying?
Well, the argument is very simple, how basically there is absolutely no law that prohibits a private company to sell those kind of items, that as well religious freedom is guaranteed in France. And that's something that is crucial here.
Has the Muslim community had a voice in this very ugly public relations controversy?
They tried, but they're not given a voice. When they try to make a point, participate to the debate, because they're French citizens, right? They're concerned. They are called Islamo-lefties, Muslim Brotherhood. You are a threat to our civilization, you know. No Muslim women were invited to debate on it. No one.
So it sounds like Angelique Thibault, who designed the sports hijab, she's making the point that you ban that and you're also preventing Muslim women, certain Muslim women, from taking part in sports.
Yes, everything is a contradiction. It's like you are not integrated, but as soon as, you know, you go to swim, you go for a run, you know, you wear a hijab, you want to sell pastries in a Christmas market and you kicked out. So you have to integrate, but basically on our terms, otherwise stay at home. You know, when a Muslim woman wearing a hijab clean your office or the toilets or take care of your kids or your elders, nobody cares. They're invisible, you know. But as soon as a Muslim woman wearing a headscarf is empowered, has degrees, fully participate to the civil society, all of a sudden, she's a threat. Why? What does it mean to be French today? Where are we going? It's scary.
What does this moment represent for France?
This moment, like, I think France seriously has to pose and look at itself in the mirror and ponder what kind of society we want to live in. Forcing a woman to remove her hijab or force her to dress a certain way is a violation of women's rights. Forcing a woman to wear a hijab or to, you know, dress a certain way, behave a certain way is a violation of women's rights, of human dignity. So, you know, if this is happening to Muslims, it will happen and it is happening to everyone else. We live in a liberal democracy and we should actually be very careful.
Rimsar Alouane is a human rights researcher. She's based in Toulouse, France. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's the sound of an icebreaker crashing through the ice in the Amundsen Sea off West Antarctica. The ship is the Nathaniel B. Palmer. The sound was recorded by the world's Carolyn Beeler. She's been on board for roughly a month now, and just this week, the ship finally reached its destination, the massive Thwaites Glacier. The Palmer is carrying a team of researchers from the U.S. and the U.K. They're part of a five-year effort to study the glacier and its possible impact on global sea levels as Antarctica warms up. So, Carolyn, you finally made it to the Thwaites Glacier. What's it like?
It's pretty stunning, Carol. We arrived before sunrise, around 4 a.m., and there was fog in the air, and it was feeling very ethereal. We pulled up to this thick wall of ice that just stretched for miles in front of us and behind us, and it was almost glowing in the pre-dawn light.
I'm looking at this picture you sent after you arrived, and it's just a massive wall of ice in front of an empty sea as far as you can see to the horizon. It's pretty incredible, even from here, looking at a picture.
Yeah, it was pretty awe-inspiring. And as I said, we arrived before dawn and it was snowing. And then as day broke, we got to see the colors within the ice. So the cracks glow a blue that's like the sky on the bluest day you can think of. And there's some teal aquamarine shining through from the underwater portion. And we were actually able to get incredibly close to it because we arrived on such a still day. We were just a couple hundred yards from it, which doesn't sound that close, but when it's that close to something so big, I didn't believe we were actually that far away. It felt like I could almost reach out and touch it. But at one point, I was standing up on the bridge with some other folks, and somebody said, "Oh, I think we can hear an echo of our voices bouncing off of the glacier face." So we all tried to yell and see if we could hear the echo, and it's pretty faint. I don't know if you're going to be able to hear it on the radio, but there was an echo coming back off of this giant wall of ice right in front of us, which was pretty cool.
That was amazing.
How's everybody on the ship feeling after finally reaching your destination?
Everyone's thrilled. It's been a long wait. Folks have been working on their proposals and trying to get here for years. So everyone was walking around with big grins on their faces. And for hours, a bunch of us were up on the bridge just watching Thwaites go by. But it's not just sort of this feeling of awe. It's the finally we get to do the science we came here to do. So I was standing up there on the bridge with Rob Larder, who's the chief scientist on the expedition. And he was just remarking on how important this place is.
This is a critical boundary in the world today. This is Thwaites Glacier, which we've been telling everybody. This is where rapid change is really happening. And we're actually standing and looking at the bit that's rapidly changing.
Wow. So now that you're there, what will you and the researchers be doing?
There are a lot of different science projects happening. So within about the first, 14 hours of being at Thwaites, we traced the entire accessible edge of it and mapped this area that was uncharted previously. Since then, we've steamed a little bit seaward from the glacier face. They'll be taking sediment cores of this seabed to better understand historic changes. They also will be testing out the Hugin, which is a robotic submarine that has really sophisticated technology to measure the ocean water and map in even higher detail the ocean floor. So those are some of the highlights.
Is there going to be any way for scientists to figure out how much the Thwaites Glacier has broken off or receded?
Well, the whole West Antarctic ice sheet back at the last glacial maximum used to reach all the way out to the continental shelf of Antarctica. And since then, it's receded. And better figuring out what happened in the past will help the scientists figure out what's going to happen in the future, right? So having this data of past change will allow modelers to help figure out how much and how fast Thwaites might melt and or collapse going forward.
Are you and the people on that ship, are you the first people ever to go to that area?
We're the first people to be in a lot of the places that the ship is going. So seeing the portions of the glacier that we're seeing, yeah, we're the first people to do that. A lot of the areas that we are seeing have previously always been covered in sea ice, so they've been inaccessible by ship. So some of the portions that we're seeing, we are the first humans to see.
Wow, do you feel like an explorer?
Yeah, it does feel a little bit like being one of those early polar explorers. And it was really cool to experience this magnificent sight with scientists who know so much about what we're seeing and came down here not just to be among the first to see what we're seeing, but to be among the first to understand what's causing the changes.
What's the most incredible thing you've seen so far?
That is a really hard question to answer. I think this just giant wall of ice stretching as far as you can see for miles and miles is probably the coolest. But we also got to see something pretty cool. There was maybe about a dozen emperor penguins on this piece of floating sea ice. And when the ship approached, they one by one slid on their bellies off of this piece of ice and started swimming and porpoising just like dolphins do, in front of and then alongside the ship. So I was thinking from their perspective, they have never seen anything like the ship before, and they weren't afraid. They were just kind of curious, swimming alongside the ship. So that was pretty amazing.
The world's Carolyn Beeler on the Nathaniel B. Palmer research ship. She's in Antarctica with a group of scientists who are going to be investigating the Thwaites Glacier. Thanks, Carolyn.
You're welcome, Carol.
Carolyn sent us some truly fabulous pictures of this unexplored stretch of ice. You can catch them and get caught up on her journey so far at theworld.org. The photos are also on Instagram. We're at PRI The World. And if you have a question for Carolyn about life on board the Nathaniel B. Palmer or research into climate change in Antarctica, email her. The address is myworld@theworld.org. The music of Ulafer Arnold sounds like it could be the soundtrack for a trek through stretches of previously unexplored ice. Okay, maybe that's not the effect he was going for. On the other hand, Ulafer Arnold is from Iceland, where I'm pretty sure he's seen a glacier or two. Anyway, this is the title track from his latest release, Remember. Crisp, cool, electronic, ambient pop to wrap things up today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.